This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll discuss the history of Temple B'nai Israel in Kalamazoo, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary this month. But first, Jason Dalton is accused of killing six people and severely wounding two others in three separate shootings in the Kalamazoo area on February 20th. Dalton was found competent to stand trial, but that does not preclude him from mounting an insanity defense. To explain how this works, we've turned to Tanya Krausfielen. She's a professor at the Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley Law School. She has also been a criminal defense attorney. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Can you give us a brief history of how mental capacity is considered in deciding guilt or innocence and in the defense that a criminal defendant can put out?
That's an excellent question. Yes. Going back to the earliest times in our criminal justice system, we as a society have always been hesitant to prosecute and punish the very, very young and the very, very mentally ill. And the thought behind that is someone who is very young does not have a completely developed brain, and someone who is very mentally ill, there is some illness causing the brain not to function properly. And because our system defines crimes by a guilty act and a guilty state of mind, when the juvenile or youthful offender or the individual with mental illness acts in what otherwise would be considered a crime, there's a question of whether they formed that evil state of mind or that criminal state of mind. And to this day, we still carry that concept out in our system because we have a separate system for juvenile offenders, and there's been a lot of law recently about the lack of capacity until someone's about the age of 22-ish, and we still allow for the insanity defense in our community because we continue to recognize that idea that someone who has a serious mental illness can't form that evil criminal state of mind the way someone can who doesn't have that serious mental disease.
So as I noted, Jason Dalton has been found competent to stand trial. Explain the difference between being found competent to stand trial and mounting an insanity defense.
Right. And what's interesting is both of those concepts can take place in one trial, in one case. Competency is what we refer to as a procedural defense, and insanity is a legal defense. So let me start with competency. Competency requires that a defendant be able to participate in his case, in his defense. And so we ask ourselves questions like, is this offender able to understand the nature of the charges against him? And does he have the capacity to assist and communicate with his lawyer regarding his defense? Now, competency, what we're looking at is, can we continue to prosecute this individual right now in real time? If somebody is incompetent, and it has to be determined by a mental health professional, and I'll explain that in a second, we can't continue to prosecute them. Our system of justice says that it would be unfair to prosecute someone who, due to mental defect, cannot understand what's going on and can't participate in his case. Now, how this usually comes up is the defense attorney or someone within the system will note that the individual either has a history of mental illness and or is presenting symptoms of mental illness. And it's often raised by the defense attorney with the court to say, hey, you know, look, Your Honor, my client has a serious mental illness, and because of that, he doesn't understand the nature of the charges and he can't assist me in the defense. Once that issue is raised, the case actually takes a timeout. And everything is put on hold while the defendant is examined by an appropriate mental health official and a determination is made if there's a mental illness and if it is making him incompetent to stand trial.
So we have reached the point where we do know Jason Dalton is competent to stand trial. We don't know yet what's going to happen when they actually get to a trial date. But if someone were mounting an insanity defense, what sort of evidence are they allowed to present in court to make the case that perhaps this person did commit the act for which they've been charged, but they were in such a state at the time that we cannot find them guilty of it?
Yeah, you said something in your question that is an excellent point that I'd like to start with, and that's when we're talking about the insanity defense, we're talking about what the defendant's state of mind was at the time of the alleged offense. So competency, we're looking at the defendant's state of mind during the actual proceedings themselves. Insanity goes to what was that person's state of mind at the time. And in this particular case, or any case where insanity is raised, there are a whole host of types of evidence that can be used. For example, does the person have a mental health history? That's going to be one of the first starting points for the mental health professional that examines the individual to determine if they were insane at the time that the offense was committed. Because in the state of Michigan, it has to be a serious mental health issue, a serious mental state or disease. So that has to be determined by a mental health professional. Then it comes down to how was the person acting? What did the person say? And in this case, there is some evidence that someone who had been inside the car with the defendant called 911 and said, look, dude's acting crazy, or this was a crazy ride, or something to that effect. And lay people can actually make observations about whether someone is, quote-unquote, acting crazy. So really, any of that type of evidence, mental health professionals about the disease or defect, things the defendant said or did leading up to and during the alleged offense, and what other people witnessed regarding the defendant's statements and conduct all become relevant questions.
So there's an interesting point there about this: the defendant's actions at the time or leading up to the committing of the crime. And I guess that leads me to wonder if that statement from the person who got this Uber ride about how the driver was erratic and was going all over the place, is that going to be maybe more salient to the question than some other things like Mr. Dalton's outburst in court during a preliminary exam, where, of course, that's well after the crime has been committed. So,
sure.
So do his actions leading right up to the crime, or maybe the time he was arrested, is that going to maybe be more relevant, at least legally, than what might have happened afterward?
Well, it depends what we're talking about. It's going to be more relevant if we're talking about the issue of insanity, because, again, with insanity, we're focusing on the defendant's state of mind at the time of the alleged offense. So those witnesses who were in his car that day or who observed his driving that day, that is really relevant and likely admissible to his state of mind at the time of the offense. Now, any conduct that happened inside the courtroom, while it may have some relevance to his state of the mind at the time of the offense, if it relates to his mental disease or defect, to me it seems like it has more relevance, his conduct in the courtroom, on whether he is currently competent to stand trial. And again, two very different concepts.
And that's already been determined. He is competent to stand trial.
It has been, but here's the interesting thing about competency. It can be raised at any time during the proceedings because, again, the concept is procedural. In other words, we don't want to continue prosecuting someone who's not competent to stand trial. And let me give you an example of that I think will help the listeners understand, is oftentimes people with mental disease or defect have to be medicated. And if they're appropriately medicated, the manifestations of their illness can be brought under control. If the individual stops taking their medication, they can start, again, exhibiting the behavior that's a manifestation of their mental disease or defect. If that happens, sometimes the case has to take a time out while the person resumes their medication and gets back to a sustainable level of competency. It's not uncommon for competency to actually come and go in the course of a trial.
So on the other side of the courtroom, we have the prosecution. What are some of the things that they can present to make the argument that this person is guilty, should not be found guilty by reason of insanity, and that was not a mitigating factor, if you will, in the crime that was committed.
Sure. Actually, very similar to what I mentioned earlier, the prosecutor is going to be looking at the defendant's behavior and statements leading up to the time of the offense. And if there are individuals who can speak to the defendant's ability to think and act rationally, that is going to be very helpful to the prosecutor to try to negate the insanity defense.
One of the main reasons, of course, that we have a criminal justice system in our society is to protect the citizens at large from people who would do them harm. And I suppose that is what some people may wonder about, why we have a possibility here of someone being found not guilty by reason of insanity. Should people be worried about the possibility that someone who is found not guilty by reason of insanity, that they are going to walk free and perhaps be amongst us again, capable of committing an act like what we saw in February in Kalamazoo?
You raise such an interesting question, and you're absolutely right. There are instances in our legal history where people with severe mental illness have committed heinous crimes against other individuals, and that can be scary. But what people have to understand is that a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity does not release the individual back into the community. That word not guilty as part of the verdict sounds like the person would be released from the criminal justice system, but the exact opposite is true. An individual who is found not guilty by reason of insanity actually becomes under the control of the probate or mental health system. And in the state of Michigan, there are still a few dedicated facilities throughout the state that deal specifically with people with mental health situations. And so that's where the individual would go. And they stay in that mental health facility until such time that the probate court system decides that they're no longer a threat to themselves or the community.
Michigan also has an option for a defendant to be found guilty but mentally ill. What would happen then?
Yeah, guilty but mentally ill is not really a defense at all. All it is a flag to the Department of Corrections that the individual was found by the jury to have mental health issues. So if that is the verdict that is lodged, the person does in fact go to prison and is designated to receive the mental health treatment available by the state.
As I noted, you have done some work in criminal defense. Based on your experience, is it common to see someone raise the insanity defense at trial?
It's not uncommon. And especially, and I don't mean for this to sound like any type of political statement at all, but we live in a time when mental health funding is not abundant. And there's all kinds of statistics and data that indicate that the prisons in our country are filled with people with mental illness. So that's my way of leading into the answer that no, it's not uncommon. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's not uncommon. I think the more interesting part of the answer to that question is very rarely does a jury find a defendant not guilty by reason of insanity.
And that was going to be my next question was,
yeah.
You know, as a defense, is it something that has a high percentage of working, or is it something that, you know, maybe just a few juries here and there, I don't know if we could put a percentage on it, say, yes, not guilty by reason of insanity.
I don't know. There probably is a percentage. I don't have that at my fingertips. But, you know, interestingly, I think a lot of juries think that it's easy to fake mental illness, or that a defendant is using it as an excuse, or they feel very much like the question you asked a few minutes ago, that, yeah, we think this person has some serious mental health issues, but boy, we just don't want them back out on the street because they're dangerous.
Tanya Krause-Phelan, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Tanya Krause-Phelan is a professor at Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School.